Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, an Alaskan Native corporation promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. The Exxon Valdez was refloated today, and the wreck's being towed to a sheltered bay for repairs. Meanwhile, Governor Steve Cooper says Exxon's cleanup is too slow and has asked the Coast Guard to take over. Good evening. I'm Corey Flintoff. More tonight on the largest oil spill in North American history. People on the Kenai Peninsula and Kodiak Island are just beginning to appreciate its magnitude. The tide did rise and the ship did float today in Prince William Sound. The tanker Exxon Valdez floated clear of Bligh Reef this morning about 10:30. Roseanne Smith reports what's happening to the ill-fated ship today.
Salvage crews pumped compressed air into the refloated Exxon Valdez on Wednesday, readying it for the 30-mile journey to Outside Bay on Naked Island. The tanker, under tugboat escort, will remain in the already polluted bay for a temporary repair. Exxon officials say they're still looking for a port that will accept the ship, since Portland is balking because of its own worries about pollution. The Coast Guard reported at midday Wednesday that no oil was immediately seen as the ship was floated off Bligh Reef, but a Coast Guard spokesman says there's a good chance an oil sheen will show up. A light skimmer ship is following the tanker for cleanup. Reports out of Valdez suggest the tanker may reach Outside Bay by midnight. It's said to be moving at about 2 knots, a little better than a mile an hour. Also, there was word Wednesday that Exxon is testing a cleanup product called O-Spray, oil remover made of highly compressed cork. The cork is injected into the water, floats to the top, absorbing oil as it goes. The oily cork is then skimmed off. Someone who watched a test of the stuff in Valdez called it amazingly effective, especially since the cork has no bad effect on the water. 5 tons of cork product are said to be in Valdez already, awaiting Exxon's okay. In Anchorage, I'm Roseanne Smith.
Governor Steve Cooper asked the U.S. Coast Guard to assume command of the Exxon Valdez oil spill cleanup today. Cooper said too little oil's been recovered so far, and for the sake of the environment, something has to change. John Greeley reports.
What Prince William Sound needs, says Governor Cooper, is a military-style cleanup. So far, the three-headed management structure with Exxon in the lead, the Coast Guard, and the state sharing in the decisions just has not worked. Cooper estimates that only 4% of the oil has been recovered despite what he termed the good faith of Exxon. But good faith aside, Cooper told reporters here that results are what counts.
Exxon's bureaucracy was so large that it was very difficult to get things done, and that we need a much more disciplined management system on that spill. We have to get things done in a hurry, in other words.
And Cooper says that means giving orders and having them followed, something he believes the Coast Guard can do as one branch of the military. The governor also is pinning some hope on the arrival of a big Soviet oil skimmer, dwarfing any of the 18 now in operation in the Sound. Docked on a Soviet-controlled island north of Japan, the 425-foot ship has a crew of 41 men, and Cooper says it could be here in 2 weeks or less. That may seem like a long time, but the governor says it appears an increasing amount of oil is entering the water column of Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska down to depths of 90 feet. There it will sit.
The evidence is that North Slope crude in cold water does not break up like other oil does. So it may be there for a very long time if we don't figure out some way of getting it out of there.
Governor said he doesn't want to raise expectations too high, but the Soviet ship could be used both in Prince William Sound and the Gulf of Alaska to recover oil no other machine could reach. First, a Coast Guard officer and a shipping expert under contract to Exxon must examine the Soviet vessel on Sakhalin Island, then the long voyage to Valdez. In announcing his request for a Coast Guard takeover of the entire cleanup, Cooper said the focus remains on getting oil out of the water. Job number two is cleaning the beaches. Exxon, he said, is still responsible for paying the cost of the cleanup, but he's hopeful the pace can pick up with a change of command. In Juneau, I'm John Greeley.
In Cordova, the reaction to Governor Cooper's announcement was clear. People on that side of Prince William Sound are upset at the pace of cleanup efforts, with some describing the commitment of Exxon and Alyeska as half-hearted. R.J. Kopchak is vice mayor of Cordova and a gill netter.
I really wish that Steve would have done it about 6 days ago, but now is as good a time, I guess, as any. It's better today than tomorrow. After flying the Sound today, it's evident to anybody that looks that Exxon still hasn't taken necessary steps, so perhaps the Coast Guard and the government will respond.
Exxon's spill manager representative in Cordova, Dave Pierce, was unavailable for comment. The former skipper of the Exxon Valdez gave himself up to New York authorities this morning and is now in jail with bail set at $500,000. The three charges facing Joseph Hazelwood are only misdemeanors, but the judge who set his bail called the Exxon oil spill a man-made destruction that has not been equaled, probably, since Hiroshima. Attorney General Doug Bailey said he was pleased that the state will be spared the trouble of extraditing Hazelwood.
Well, I think it's adequate to ensure his appearance, and I compliment the judge in New York. We had only asked for $50,000, and the multiple of 10 is certainly satisfactory to us.
Attorney General Doug Bailey. The threat of the Exxon Valdez oil spill swirling into Lower Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay increased today when the wind shifted direction and began steering the oil toward the coast of the Kenai Peninsula. For the past several days, the oil's been hovering off Cape Resurrection near Seward. Thanks to north winds, the oil had stayed out of Resurrection Bay and off the coastline of the Kenai Fjords National Park. That changed today when the winds began coming from the south. We have two reports from Homer, the first from Joe Gallagher.
For the past couple of days, biologists and other people keeping an eye on the progress of the oil slick said the key to how much damage the oil would cause to Cook Inlet and Kachemak Bay was the wind. The worst thing that could happen was a south wind, and that's exactly what's blowing out in the Gulf of Alaska right now. Fish and Game biologist Rance Morrison.
It looks like from the current patterns that exist in the Gulf of Alaska that go through Kennedy Entrance into Kachemak Bay and to Cook Inlet, that with a southeast wind, it's pretty likely that the wind and the current together would bring oil into Cook Inlet and probably into Kachemak Bay.
The news has put a spark of urgency to plans already underway to try and protect critical salmon streams and habitat areas along the coastline of the Kenai Peninsula and Kachemak Bay. The city of Homer has sent a representative over to Seward to work with the multi-agency task force there. The borough assembly has approved an emergency appropriation of $200,000 and is ready to release another $2.8 million on the condition the borough is reimbursed. And Fish and Game says its primary concern is the Tutka Bay hatchery, where millions of pink salmon fry are released each spring into Lower Cook Inlet. Fishermen are meeting on a daily basis trying to make sure that their concerns are being met. Cook Inlet Seiners Association spokesman Chris Moss says he wants to make sure there's a plan in place to deal with the oil before it hits Cook Inlet.
Seems like you move the organization from Valdez to Seward and to Homer, and it seems to be more as a result of where the oil is rather than in preparation for the oil, and that's our concern right now is for the Cook Inlet region, Kachemak Bay, is that we've got to get something in place prior to the oil getting here rather than waiting for it to show up on our doorstep.
Homer fisherman Chris Moss.
I'm Laura Wilkie. The villages of Port Graham and English Bay are located on the south side of Kachemak Bay, where oil entering the area would strike even before it reached Homer, and both villages are virtually defenseless. Chief Walter McGannick of Port Graham says his village has no contingency plan whatsoever.
My feeling is hoping it's not good here. I don't know what we're going to do if it does get here. We don't have no equipment to take care of it here. We expect that something like that's going to happen. Someday it happened. It happened, so it don't look good, okay?
Chief McGannick says although the villagers in Port Graham are worried, So far, they've seen the oil spill as an employment opportunity. He says nearly the entire village has signed up to go over to Prince William Sound to help in the cleanup effort. English Bay is perched even farther out on the tip of the Kenai Peninsula, and villagers there would see the oil first. Emily Swenning, secretary of the village council, says the people of English Bay are not waiting around to see what happens to their food supply.
A lot of the people in the village are going down to the reef and behind the point at low tide to pick bidarkies and clams and seaweed, mussels and snails, just in case the oil does come into the Lower Cook Inlet, and because they're saying that, you know, we couldn't pick this stuff or probably use any of the fish for a certain amount of years, and they're going down every low tide to get as much as they can so they'll have some, just in case the oil spill hits us here.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Laura Wilkie.
While Exxon and state officials are channeling cleanup efforts to areas already affected by the oil spill, frustration is mounting in Kodiak. There's a strong possibility patches of oil will start reaching the island in a matter of days, but organizing a defense against the slick has only just started. Charlene Parent reports.
For a while there, experts were saying chances of the oil getting to Kodiak were pretty remote, and if it did travel that far, the slick would be dispersed. So it took everyone by surprise this week when scientists said the oil is not dispersing and is heading rapidly for Kodiak. The National Weather Service says oil patches may start reaching the island as early as Friday. Meanwhile, the majority of Kodiak's containment materials are in Valdez, along with a number of Kodiak's Coast Guard vessels, leaving the community unprotected. In the past 2 days, a flurry of meetings have been held to take stock of the situation. Over 100 people crowded into the borough assembly chambers today for a meeting of Kodiak's Emergency Services Committee. Exxon spokesman Monty Taylor hooked up to the meeting by teleconference. Kodiak wants Exxon to front money and materials so the community can prepare for the oil spill. But Exxon, which is looking only at 24-hour projections of the spill, is not convinced it's necessary to commit resources to Kodiak. Exxon spokesman Monty Taylor.
Kodiak is still far enough away that at least the history of other spills has been that even if it heads for Kodiak, it will pretty well be dissipated. You won't be able to find any oil by the time you get there. Now, I don't know whether that's right or not. But I do know that Kodiak is still quite a ways away.
That didn't go down very well with the audience at today's meeting. No one wants to wait till the oil arrives to do something about it.
Well, like the motto of the Boy Scouts, be prepared. And I think we should look at that. And in order to be prepared, I see the news where the oil is moving at a certain rate and it's here. And all of a sudden they're surprised because it moves so fast. It's moved much faster than they anticipated. Now that's where we have to come in as Boy Scouts. We have to not talk about 24 hours. We have to talk about being prepared as soon as we can, and I think this group up here is doing a fine job, but I still think we need to get all the people involved. Bring the people here from Cordova. Bring the people here from Valdez, and let's have a meeting, and let's try to get everything so we don't have any unanswered questions.
Meanwhile, local preventive efforts are intensifying. The emergency committee is in the process of identifying critical habitat areas, hatcheries and salmon streams, and a list of cleanup volunteers is being compiled. The United Fishermen's Marketing Association is organizing the fishing fleet. Reporting from Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
Lawyers for more than 500 fishermen in Prince William Sound have taken Exxon and Alyeska to court, demanding financial compensation and a thorough cleanup of the fishing grounds. But the big lawsuits are only part of the picture. The town of Cordova and its people are seeking their own reparations, money that in some cases is needed now. As Brian Mann reports, $5 million of Exxon money has arrived in Cordova, but it's wrapped in red tape.
The people of Cordova are sick of attorneys. There's a joke here that the only ones to arrive before the news media were the lawyers, out to make a buck from one of the largest disasters in Alaska's history. As oil spreads over the Sound's prime fishing grounds, however, legal action is sure to become a way of life here. On Friday, attorneys for the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association, the Cordova District Fishermen's United, and the Saners Association filed joint suits in state and federal court, demanding full restoration of the environment and compensation for lost harvests. Already lost are the combined herring fisheries, valued at roughly $12 million, which were canceled Monday by the Department of Fish and Game. How much damage will be done before the oil is gone from Prince William Sound, no one knows. Lewis Gordon is an attorney with Ashburn and Mason, the Anchorage firm representing the fishermen. He says there will be a meeting soon with Exxon officials, in part to demand immediate compensation. Fishermen are low on cash in the spring, and they need money now.
The suit was filed against Exxon and Alyeska, and other groups have joined in the suit since Friday. The suit seeks to recover damages for the losses that the fishermen and the hatcheries have already suffered and will suffer, as well as punitive damages due to the recklessness of Exxon and Alyeska in allowing the spill to happen and in failing to properly clean it up.
Meanwhile, the city of Cordova and individuals are starting to deal with the immediate hardship caused by a canceled herring fishery. In a meeting Monday night, only hours after Fish and Game announced their decision, the town council passed a resolution calling for city staff to prepare new assessments of public and private property. The objective, to determine just how much value has been lost. Be it further resolved, the document continues, that the city will look to Exxon for compensation. City Councilman Mike Anderson.
I can't see property changing hands in the next 60 days or so and retaining its value. Past that, who can guess?
After a discussion of falling real estate values, Mayor Erling Johansson raised the issue of fish house workers and crewmen, shorter on funds perhaps than even the boat owners. Are they going to bring a suit against Exxon, he asked? And if so, how do they survive until that suit is through? Randy Campbell is a claims adjuster representing Exxon. The company has deposited $5 million in a Cordova bank, he says, but he's waiting for orders from Exxon before writing the first check. He's not sure when that clearance will come. When the money does start to flow, Campbell will face a second problem, trust, or the lack of it. At Monday's town council meeting, Chamber of Commerce Representative Steve Rimberg made the barbed jest that Exxon's logo is a double cross. The comment drew laughter, but nods as well. Signing up for immediate assistance, they'll be cheated or tricked into giving up future claims. Scott Sterling is Cordova's city attorney.
The Exxon rep that can sit there to serve as kind of an objective third-person observer, what people really need in this situation is legal representation, and that's exactly what they're not going to get, even if we still had all the lawyers that were here 4 days ago.
Claims adjuster Randy Campbell says he is seeing more people through his door, 250 so far, but the mood varies.
The trust level is still mixed on the people's behalf. They're still apprehensive, and rightly so. They don't know what's going on yet, and we haven't got any definite format yet set up as to how payment is going to be made, and any conjecture at this point would be simply that.
As the people of Cordova struggle to keep their checkbooks balanced, they listen closely for the fate of the San Juan hatchery and news from other parts of the Sound. What they want more than money is for a part of their fishery to be preserved and for life, as soon as possible, to go back to the way it was. Kathy Horner works the docks here with her husband.
Hopefully we can clean something up and save the salmon and the future salmon fries. The salmon fry right now, that'll be our future salmon in a couple of years.
Reporting from Cordova, I'm Brian Mann.
For the Chugach natives in the villages of Prince William Sound, the oil spill fouled not just their beaches, but their dinner tables. Alaska natives living on the coast have a saying, when the tide is out, the table is set. And right now, the table is a mess. The Chugach natives have filed a class action suit against Alyeska and Exxon, seeking damages for the harm that's been done to their subsistence harvests. Agnes Nichols, who chairs the EAC Tribal Council, says that she and her neighbors gather everything from seaweed to fish and mollusks. She wants Exxon to realize that the oil spill has spoiled their way of life.
To me, I would want the recognition that it isn't just the poor little animals that are suffering. It's the people that are going to be deprived of certain things out of here, you know. I know that the oil is vital to whatever we need. I mean, my house is has oil. I mean, it's operated by oil and everything else. And it's not going to be just something for this summer, but personally, I feel that it's going to be something for a good long time.
The suit, filed in federal court on behalf of the 2,000 Chugach natives relying on Prince William Sound, asks for damages and equitable relief. One of the best sources of information about Prince William Sound is actually in Fairbanks. The University of Alaska there has been collecting scientific data about the water, fish, and animals of the sound for years. Tonight, about a dozen marine scientists will board the research vessel Alpha Helix in Seward. They'll motor over to the thick of the oil to begin sampling. Robin Martin reports.
According to marine scientists at UAF, the Alpha Helix beats the pants off any other boat for this kind of research. You can cram it full of graduate students, use it for a diving platform, and sample winds, currents, tides, and salinity, and keep those samples frozen until they get back to the lab in Fairbanks. Truckloads of research equipment has already gone down the highway to meet the Alpha Helix in Seward. The vessel was in a Washington shipyard, just getting finished with some work, when the Exxon Valdez ran aground. Dr. Ted Cooney says he wants to document the recovery of Prince William Sound, which he says will take years, much like the land devastated after a volcanic eruption.
Once the oil has gotten past its most toxic stage and settlement can begin, there'll be a host of things they're attempting to colonize then this new sort of system, the Mount St. Helens recolonization.
Cooney prefers the analogy of Mount St. Helens rather than the more common comparison to Chernobyl, because marine ecosystems often deal with natural oil seeps in natural ways.
Certainly a catastrophe, but it's one that we would expect the marine system to be able to rebound from in what we hope will be a fairly predictable way, but that'll basically be the science of the matter, is to document carefully how it does rebound. Any information is worth could be worth millions of dollars in that. We had that kind of a documentation on the shelf. If somebody could have pulled the Prince William Sound book off the shelf and said, ooh, this is what happened last time, there might have been a completely different approach to how things went there.
Cooney says there's a natural flow of invertebrates into Prince William Sound, and that will help with what's called recolonization. There's also magic little hydrocarbon-eating microorganisms, and they'll consume some of the oil after it is broken down. The Alpha Helix will be sampling for those, to see if their population has been stimulated by the oil spill. All their studies will go back to the labs in Fairbanks, where they will be entered onto the computer database for Prince William Sound. Reporting from Fairbanks, I'm Robin Martin.
The Exxon Valdez disaster has stirred painful reflections for many Alaskans and some unquiet memories as well. Commentator Mary Beth Holloman offered these thoughts.
They say the Hetch Hetchy Dam broke John Muir's heart. He fought long and hard to save the other Yosemite, but he lost, and they flooded a valley we can now only know through his words. Edward Abbey, defender of the American Southwest, wrote about his final raft trip through the Glen Canyon. Though he too fought long and hard, they built a dam, and now Lake Powell covers the canyon, a lake that will fill with sediment and become useless in less than 100 years. This past week, we experienced a flooding of a different kind. Oil is covering Prince William Sound, coating rocky shores, sandy beaches, icebergs, sea otters, fish, birds, seals. Now I know what Muir and Abbey felt. For this is the first, and I pray to God the last time, I know both the privilege of experiencing pristine wilderness and the horror of seeing it devastated. Changed, if not forever, then perhaps for my lifetime. I have seen many places that have been polluted and plundered by man's actions. Chesapeake Bay, the entire Atlantic coast, Louisiana swamps, Florida Everglades, Black Hills, prairies. I grew up walking on beaches where black, slimy oil was a common, though always disheartening, encounter. Seeing one porpoise, one small school of fish, was a major event to savor for years until the next sighting. I've traveled this country, and until I saw Prince William Sound, I found myself repeating, "Wish I'd seen this before it was mined, burned, dammed, drained, clear-cut, sprayed, plowed, polluted." But unlike Muir and Abbey, I couldn't fight the flooding of the sound. We had to trust Exxon, Alyeska, all those officials, to keep their word, to keep this from happening. We were armed with nothing, it turns out, but a contingency plan full of empty promises. Last summer, my husband and I spent a day in one of the Sound's fjords. We watched a pod of sea otters, many with young pups still clinging to their bellies, frolic in a field of ice. We followed two orcas as they fed. We witnessed a flock of angry terns chase an eagle away from a tern chick paddling helplessly in the water. Harbor seals spied on us, thrusting heads up to get a better look, then disappearing if we looked at them face to face. We walked on rocky shores covered with a medley of seaweed, mussels, barnacles, snails, all in one magical day. Oil is covering Prince William Sound. I fear my heart is breaking.
The thoughts of commentator Mary Beth Holloman. There's nothing funny about the Exxon Valdez disaster, but that doesn't stop people from finding comic relief. A popular barroom joke in Anchorage is to open the door and announce a cab for Captain Hazelwood. In Valdez, the long hours and hard work resulted in this sea shanty.
Late one night in Seward's icebox, the Exxon Valdez hit the rock. Tanks of oil did divide, 10 million gallons gushed outside. The sea it turned an ugly black, but that will change when we attack. We mopped and broomed, and for her nine, we'll have it clean in little time. So grab a sponge and grab a mop, never stop while there's a drop of oil water on the ground. We're cleaning up Prince William Sound. Some call it food, some chocolate mousse, everyone's got some excuse. No matter, now it's gonna ground, and the oil's still spilling out. Cast a boom around the ship, skim the oil at the drip, clean the beaches after you, give the birds a good shampoo. So grab a sponge and grab a mop, never stop while there's a drop of oil. Hopping mad, for Exxon it has hit the fan. Their booms are broken, won't hold out. We'll buy our own, without a doubt. So grab a sponge and grab a mop, never stop while there's a drop of oil. We're on the ground, we're cleaning up Prince William Sound. We're cleaning up Prince William Sound.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Wednesday, April the 5th. We had reports tonight from Roseanne Smith of KSKA in Anchorage, John Greeley of KTOO in Juneau, Brian Mann of KCHU in Cordova, Joe Gallagher and Laura Wilkie of KBBI in Homer, and Charlene Parent of KMXT in Kodiak. Our commentator was Mary Beth Holloman, music provided by Alfonso Laundromat and Friends. APRN's Robin Martin reported from Fairbanks, Johanna Urich and Sue Burris from Anchorage. Diana Derby's our engineer with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and National Bank of Alaska for convenience in banking. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations, by the Tundra Times, keeping you up to date on statewide Native issues at 274-2512, and Charter North Hospital, providing treatment for mental health and addictive disease.
Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. Congress began hearings today on the Exxon Valdez disaster, wrestling with the issues of responsibility, both for the accident and its cleanup. Meanwhile, communities brace themselves in the path of the spill. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, a close-up look at the Battle of Sawmill Bay. Congress today began what will be a series of hearings on the Exxon Valdez oil spill. As Joel Southern reports, witnesses spent the day sorting out who's responsible, who should direct the cleanup, and who should compensate Alaskans devastated by the disaster.
House and Senate subcommittees took up the oil spill disaster, hearing from the Bush administration, Alaskan officials, the oil industry, the mayor of Valdez, and Alaskan fishermen. Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner and Coast Guard Commandant Paul Yost reiterated the spill should not have happened and that once it did, the contingency plan to clean it up was inadequate. Both said Exxon has the primary responsibility for the accident and for cleanup, aided by the Coast Guard. But control of the cleanup was a sore point for Senator Ted Stevens. He and the rest of the Alaska delegation spent yesterday urging the administration to take charge. Stevens argued the point again with Skinner in today's Senate hearing.
We've asked for the Coast Guard to coordinate this effort as it leaves Prince William Sound. Without question, it should be a federal responsibility now. And Mr. Secretary, if we don't get that, I'm going to ask the chairman and the ranking member to join me in an emergency bill to demand it.
Yeah.
We've got to have federal control now.
But Skinner and then Commandant Yost in the House hearing complained that complete federalization could cause more trouble because it might relieve Exxon of some liability. The basic problem, Yost said, is that Exxon has more to spend than the Coast Guard.
The oil liability fund, the 311K fund, is now down to some $3 or $4 million. We're looking at a $100 million, $200 million spill. We're looking at a corporate giant who has been a good corporate citizen in their response so far, willing to open their checkbook, put no limits on it. I would be very reluctant to federalize this spill with $4 million in my pocket when I know that we're spending over $100 million a day Exxon is.
Part of the testimony was spent trying to interpret Governor Steve Cooper's request late yesterday for a bigger federal role in the cleanup. Admiral Yost and Congressman Don Young discussed the Cooper request.
It was my understanding, although you're much closer to it, Mr. Congressman, it was my understanding that the governor had not gone all the way to federalization. What he had said is he would like to see the Coast Guard take a bigger role in the guidance and direction and the management of that thing, and we're willing to do that and moving to do it right now.
And I would support that with the understanding one of the weaknesses I believe in this whole incident is has come out. We had actually three generals in the field, and in the case of this war, I'd prefer the Coast Guard being the general. And if we can set it up as doing that for this spill and future spills, I think we ought to agree to that system where one person has the responsibility of directing, regardless who's responsible, of the spill.
Administration officials said the spill shows there should be tougher liability rules, better screening and licensing of ship pilots, and revamped spill contingency plans. A big issue for Alaska witnesses was who will pay for damage to fishermen and others who make their living in Prince William Sound. Alaska Lieutenant Governor Steve McAlpine and Valdez Mayor John Devens argued for emergency low-interest government loans to help victims until they can settle with Exxon. Secretary Skinner was asked if the administration could assure compensation from either the government or Exxon.
We're going to come up with a program that gives them a level of assistance that we hope will be comforting. I don't want to be any more specific than that because there are various alternatives that are being looked at, and it's not fair to prejudge any one of those. But this administration is not going to let the fishermen be in a situation where they're totally unprotected.
Mayor Devens said he was skeptical.
For some reason, I'm leaving here not totally convinced that there is a real plan that's going to take care of the victims of this problem. And that bothers me greatly.
Devens was reassured Congress will do what it can, but was warned claimed settlement will take time. Today's hearings were the first of several on the spill and its ramifications for the Alaska oil industry. Some congressmen and senators are already using the Exxon Valdez incident to fight development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. For Alaska Public Radio, this is Joel Southern in Washington, D.C.
The Exxon Valdez accident prompted panic buying among some gasoline wholesalers. Now, two major oil companies have responded by limiting gasoline deliveries to western states. Shell Oil Company and Chevron Corporation said their decision to ration gasoline was an attempt to prevent stockpiling. In Houston, Shell spokesman Bill Gibson said there is no shortage of crude, but acknowledges that this is the first time gasoline's been rationed since the Arab oil embargo of 1973 and 74. The Milne Point oil field, meanwhile, the North Slope's smallest, is back in full operation. Conoco's field shut down 2 years ago due to low oil prices. The prices are back up, and the company hopes to reach its planned production rate of 32,000 barrels a day by next year. The Coast Guard now says investigator Mark DeLosier was quoted accurately by the Anchorage Times when he told the paper that Captain Joseph Hazelton may have left the Exxon Valdez on autopilot and failed to tell the crew shortly before the vessel grounded on Bligh Reef. The Coast Guard spokesman Rick Might says it's too soon to conclude that the autopilot was the primary cause of the grounding.
So we're not saying that the statements in the paper were incorrect in the sense that the reporter reported wrongly. We're saying we don't have all the evidence in, so we can't say a lot of those conclusions that our man made are necessarily correct because the investigation is not yet over.
The paper reported that Third Mate Gregory Cousins ordered the helmsman to execute a right turn to avoid the reef, but the vessel didn't respond because the autopilot was apparently still engaged. The National Transportation Safety Board has tentatively scheduled public hearings on the spill to begin May 16th. As the oil spill moves into an ever-widening area, the issue of who will control the cleanup remains in question. A multi-agency response team is still discussing Governor Cooper's request that the Coast Guard take control from Exxon. Claire Richardson reports that support for the idea appears to be growing, largely from people who think priorities for the use of equipment and workers need to be better directed.
There is no way that anyone, from Exxon to the state to the Coast Guard, can completely manage the runaway oil spill. Jim Hayden is with the Department of Environmental Conservation.
The oil in the mainstream of Montague Strait is unmanageable. It's overwhelming. And I'm not sure it's humanly possible to control a spill of this size, no matter how much equipment is available. It's just immense.
The frustration over getting information from Exxon was voiced by DEC Commissioner Dennis Kelso.
We've not had a plan that tells us what it is that Exxon plans to do, either tomorrow or days from now. And so we've had a difficult time knowing what they were about to do, and therefore we've had a hard time with coordination. What we really need is for that Exxon effort to be targeted and managed effectively, and that's what we've been trying to encourage. And that's why we suggested that the Coast Guard needs to have a stronger role.
One such incident that came to light happened with a skimmer sent to the San Juan hatchery by Exxon to scoop up the oil. Foreman Wayne Powers says the tug and barge were called away from the critical area to assist the Exxon Valdez in its move to Naked Island.
They decided that they had to have our tug to move, to help on this when they moved the Exxon Valdez. We're sitting in place right in front of the hatchery. We're picking up oil every day. And they pulled them off at 11 o'clock last night without bringing all the people in back to the barge. There was one man left on there to try to get all his people coordinated. Now, we're out probably a mile or 2 miles from the Gulf of Alaska, and it's dark. We're out there at night, and they pulled the barge out. We still had 12, I think he had 12 guys out there with no charts, no radar on their boats, and he had to try to, it took him 3 hours to talk them all into this base so that they could come back in.
Powers, who works for a contractor hired by Alyeska, also said three skimmers remained unused in the terminal's boatyard Wednesday afternoon. Exxon and Alyeska officials could not be reached for comment. California Congressman George Miller has spent some time observing the slow cleanup and management process. Miller says he endorses Cooper's request to put the Coast Guard in charge. Miller, who chairs the House Interior Committee on Offshore Resources, says Alyeska and Exxon made promises before the spill that they just couldn't keep.
You had the representation to the public, to the Congress, to the state legislature, and the people of Alaska that that Exxon or Alyeska actually had the ability to manage and to deal with this spill in a very immediate and short response time. That has now been disproven, and I question whether or not it's in the best interest of the public or the environment to allow that to continue.
In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
The bird and animal toll of the oil spill is probably the most visible and heart-rending measure of the disaster. Now, following reports of dead rockfish and herring, fish and game workers are gearing up to start documenting the fish kill. Brian Mann has more from Cordova.
Already, fishermen have reported numerous sightings of rockfish floating belly up in Prince William Sound. According to Jim Hayden with the Department of Environmental Conservation, one sighting took place at the oil boom which protects the San Juan hatchery. Herring have also been sighted, with carcasses brought into Fish and Game headquarters here in Cordova. The problem so far has been documentation. Evelyn Biggs is a fisheries biologist.
What we're all doing here in this office right now is assessing the damage this oil spill has caused. And when you're doing that, you need to be real careful and document things formally. And you can't go on rumors or I heard this or I heard that. That doesn't stand up.
According to Biggs, videos and snapshots are needed. Also, counts of the dead fish and body samples to be tested for hydrocarbons. As of Friday, what Fish and Game is describing as a SWAT team will be in place. With an aircraft, a biologist and two divers will respond to any sightings on Prince William Sound. The focus is on herring, Biggs says, which have moved into the area in big numbers and have gathered beneath some of the heaviest slicks of oil.
I assume if it's a large fish kill, we'll respond to it regardless of species, but right now herring is the species that's coming in large numbers, and we don't really anticipate large fish kills of anything else at this point.
The number of dead herring to expect is still a question mark, according to Biggs. The oil spill in Prince William Sound is greater than anything biologists here have dealt with. On Monday, the Department of Fish and Game canceled the combined herring fisheries, valued at roughly $12 million, due to contamination of prime spawning grounds. But the herring, Biggs says, are tough fish.
You don't expect to see a lot of acute effects, which is death, immediate death. What we do expect to see and what we are going to be testing for is long-term effects. And that will be effects that might affect the fish's reproduction in future years, or it could affect the survival and hatching of the eggs that come out this year. So that's the kind of things we kind of are looking for and are expecting. However, the acute fish kills, we just don't know. Nobody in the United States has ever dealt with an oil spill this large, and so we're not sure. I'm sure there's going to be dead fish, but as far as massive kills, no, we're not really expecting that.
The SWAT team will make up one part of the Department of Fish and Game's assessment effort, as they, the National Marine Fisheries Service, and the University of Alaska document the oil spill's impact. Total assessment work, not on fish kills, but on all aspects of environmental damage caused by the Exxon Valdez, is expected to continue for at least 5 years. In Cordova, I'm Brian Mann.
Exxon was scheduled to test its new beach cleanup procedures this afternoon. The company wants to use high-pressure hoses and steam cleaning, among other techniques, to get the oil off the rocks. Steve Heimel has a report.
A cadre of state and federal officials was due to go out to Eleanor Island this afternoon to see if Exxon is any better at cleaning oil off beaches and rocky shorelines than it is at getting it off the water. Oil was pushed into Eleanor during the storm a week ago last Sunday. Now Andy Teal of Exxon subsidiary Imperial Oil says it's ready to be mopped up because the oil on the water has moved south for the most part.
There's really no point in going into an area and starting to clean it when there in fact is still oil offshore, so to speak, that could re-impact up on that beach or on the shoreline. So if you go in and clean it and there's still some oil remaining out on the water, that oil can come back and in fact destroy all your efforts. So you really have to wait until the potential for re-oiling has been eliminated, and then you go in and start the actual shoreline cleanup phase.
There are areas that will have to be cleaned repeatedly, such as the Needles, a series of rocks near Knight Island. They are covered with sea lions and birds, and they're right in the middle of an oil stream.
We identified that a few days ago as areas such as that that we do have to get in, even though there's still a potential for re-oiling in those areas with them being sensitive such as that, to go in and try and remove as much oil as you can as soon as you can. So even though it may not be practical from an economical perspective as far as cleaning those areas before the potential for re-oiling has been eliminated, due to the sensitivities, it's definitely something that we will be going in and doing to try and remove as much oil as we can to keep the oil away from the animals.
Exxon executives try to give a picture of a horde of workers who will scrub everything in the oiled area clean. Of course, that's not really physically possible. When you talk to the people who have to figure out how to actually do it, you find it's kind of a management situation. A lot of decisions have to be made. Some areas act as catchments for the oil, and skimmers are needed first. Some areas are what they call high-energy environments, and wave action will weather the oil quickly. And some areas are just hard to reach or hard to clean. A committee is setting priorities about what beaches get treated what way, and the test is aimed at showing off the ways that can be used to clean them.
Going out and seeing what we can use, getting a better feel for example, pressures of water that we can use without creating any damage. And in fact, on the rock walls, where there is minimal life associated with the intertidal zone, evaluating the steam cleaning technique to try and remove as much as we can. So from going from steam cleaning to high pressure, to medium pressure, to low pressure, seeing which is, in fact, the most effective and which has the least impact as far as being efficient, but the least impact from an ecological perspective.
The test has been put off at least once so far. The state scientific team, meanwhile, is recording beach profiles of affected areas so they can see if Exxon puts it back the way it was after they're done trying to clean it. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Steve Heimel.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Kodiak scrambles to collect protective equipment as the huge oil slick moves closer. Up next, a report from the Battle of Sawmill Bay. A fresh load of booms arrived in Sawmill Bay this morning as crude oil continues to stream past Montague Island on its way to the Gulf of Alaska. 16,000 feet of large-size sea boom will be used to establish a new perimeter around the entrance to Sawmill Bay. Managers at the San Juan Hatchery are waiting to release 117 million young pink salmon into the water sometime in the next 3 to 5 weeks. State Spill Response Coordinator Jim Hayden says that the hatchery is safe today, largely because of two factors: unusually good weather and a massive effort by Prince William Sound fishermen to save their resource.
They are naturals on the water. They seine for herring, they seine for salmon, and now they're seining for oil. And it's the same process. We can hardly hold them back. We're trying to keep them on the line and defend San Juan. And they continually want to go out into the heavy oil that's streaming down Montague Strait, and we have to hold them back. We have to keep getting them back.
The seiners and other workers are corralling oil into small areas that can be sucked up by vacuum trucks mounted on barges. Peter Kenyon visited Sawmill Bay and prepared this report.
Dinner time on the Aurora. This small ferry that usually carries southeast residents on the Juneau to Sitka run is covered with cardboard and wood to protect against oil-soaked boots and clothing. The car deck is crammed with absorbent pads, oil snare, and rakes and shovels for beach cleanup. Up in the bar, from which all alcohol has been removed, Department of Environmental Conservation officials huddle with fishermen and hatchery workers to map out the defense of Sawmill Bay. Hatchery manager Eric Prestigard says so far, so good. Oil has yet to get past the second of three layers of protective booms, but he knows this battle has barely begun.
This is going to be an ongoing thing for a while. This is an incredible amount of oil.
Pausing for a moment in the Aurora's observation deck, environmental field officer Teresa Zvancara agrees that so far it hasn't been too bad. She's had 2 dead otters and 27 birds so far. But that's just what's floating on the water, she says. They haven't had time to begin walking the beaches yet. With fully half of the protective booms on the Sound placed here to protect this hatchery, and more on the way, Zvancara says the bay still has a chance.
We have a great group of people from Cordova that are out here, a lot of fishermen, and there's a group of high school students. They're using the skiffs to go out and corral the oil so the skimmers can collect it. And they're also putting out protective boom.
Even with hopes running high, the disaster is taking its emotional toll. Sankara says now she knows what it must be like to work in a war zone. She spends much of her day tending to wounded bodies or collecting dead ones, while overhead the rapid-fire thump of helicopter rotors, the whine of small plane engines, and the muffled squawk of walkie-talkies fill the air.
Great Kilo Alpha, traffic of beam the tanker. Will remain mid-channel 500 northbound, over.
From above, the scene broadens. Rainbow pools and thicker snakes of crude oil meander across the water. Thick brown residue gathers on one side of a piece of boom. An opaque sheen appears on the other. Seagulls skim the poisonous surface looking for a meal. The helicopter lands at the village of Chinega Bay, about 60 residents, mostly native, mostly fishermen. Two of these fishermen, Mike and Pete, take me on a skiff tour of the bay. The activity is frantic. Dozens of seiners in smaller boats towing boom into position. Barges loaded with skimmers and vacuum trucks loom in the distance. Curious sea otters poke their heads through the oily sheen, preening constantly, unaware that the oil is eating away at their protective insulation. The smell of oil is everywhere. That may be the most powerful impression of all, sitting in one of the most impressive wilderness areas in the world and finding that it smells like an industrial wasteland. Bettles Island has seen much heavier action than the area around the hatchery. The tide has been going out for a few hours now, and the small island is completely ringed with a thick black stripe of crude, oozing down among the rocks. A cormorant skitters weakly out of the way, barely able to scramble up onto the rocks. Its graceful neck is arched over slimy, pitch-black feathers. Although it's still too fast for us to catch, Mike says it's not long for this world. Around another corner, Pete points to a trail of bubbles ahead of us. A sea otter pops through the surface, alert and curious, looking fine. Then, with a sniff and a jerk of its head, it turns and dives, revealing a deadly stain that covers three-fourths of its body. Back on the Aurora, Pete Selenoff thinks about the damage this spill will cause. He says the villagers are furious, but they don't know what to do. He has three daughters, age 1.5 to 13, and he doesn't know what to tell them.
It's really sad, you know. I lived in the city before, Anchorage, Valdez, Cordova, and all, Tepet Lake, and finally come back home after all these years, you know. And I just don't know what the future holds.
On our way back to Valdez, we pass over the heavily hit areas, Night and Naked Islands, caked with thick black sludge. The use of war imagery to describe the cleanup effort has become almost routine, but like some analogies, it doesn't fit exactly. The Battle of Sawmill Bay provides no sense of patriotism or promise of glory, only a lingering sadness as the people who have to live here come to grips with senseless destruction on a massive scale. As we approach the oil terminal, an Arco tanker glides slowly past the accident site, flanked by its mandatory two-tug escort. Not far behind is a seiner, stripped of its fishing gear and loaded with cleanup supplies. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Peter Kenyon.
Rumors are flying thick and fast in Seward as people continue to watch for signs of oil swirling their way. There's a light sheen of oil at the south end of Resurrection Bay at Harding Gateway. The sheen extends south and west, engulfing the Chiswell Islands, and heavier stringers of dark brown, foamy oil are streaming by Granite Cape, heading south and west. The city of Seward's trying to keep up with the encroaching oil, laying deflection booms for protection. But a load of boom that arrived yesterday had to be returned. It wasn't the quality the city ordered and wasn't usable. So Seward chartered a 727 jet and replacement booms on its way from the manufacturer. It should arrive tonight or tomorrow. Kodiak's plea for information and assistance to prepare for the oil spill was answered today, but getting a suitable supply of containment materials may be more of a problem. Charlene Parent reports.
Coast Guard Captain Rene Roussel, head of the Marine Detachment Office in Anchorage, flew in today to meet with Kodiak's emergency committee. Roussel said he's been in constant contact with Exxon and has commitments for skimmers for Kodiak, Seward, and Homer, along with recovery equipment, training for bird cleanup, and training for boom deployment.
we in the Coast Guard are increasing our resources here and focusing our resources on supporting Exxon in their effort to try to mitigate as much of the problem as may impact Kodiak. They cannot stop the oil from coming here. There's no miracle cure for that. It's in the hands of the big weatherman right now.
What can be done right now, says Roussel, is prioritize critical areas and identify the resources needed to protect those areas. Kodiak is in the process of doing that now. Also at the meeting was Ernie Piper, a representative of Governor Cooper's office.
My specialty in government is breaking log jams within organizations. Is this cleanup, just like state government or the federal government or anything else, is its own internal forces that start working, and it tends to clog things up. My specialty is getting them unclogged. The other thing is to get information from the community, from the people in the community, and making sure that that accurate information is getting right onto the third floor in Juneau and into Steve Cooper's office.
Piper said he would also be giving fishermen information on filing claims if that becomes necessary. Later in the day, four Exxon representatives arrived and assured the emergency committee help is on the way. Exxon will base an on-site coordinator in Kodiak to help prepare for the spill. But there's already a problem getting containment materials. Exxon has committed its supply of lightweight boom to areas already affected by the oil, and the local Coast Guard has only about 1,200 feet available. The emergency committee estimates 6,000 feet is needed just to get started protecting three critical bays north of Kodiak on Afognak Island. Reporting for Kodiak, I'm Charlene Parent.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Thursday, April the 4th. We had reports tonight from Claire Richardson of KCHU in Valdez and Brian Mann in Cordova, and from Charlene Parent of KMXT in Kodiak. APRN's Steve Heimel reported from Valdez and Peter Kenyon from Sawmill Bay. Our Washington correspondent is Joel Southern. Diana Derby is our engineer with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. Chris Badalek is engineering at KCHU in Valdez. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and the Sheraton Anchorage Hotel, the hospitality people. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.